I don't get all the roaring lion and March metaphors, but there's definitely snow on the ground outside here in Arlington, Virginia. But that won't stop the dedicated crew here at Picture Lock from bringing you another stellar episode. I'll talk with president of the Washington, D.C. Area Film Critics Association, Tim Gordon, about how he got into film criticism and why he started the Black Reel Awards. We're just a couple of weeks removed from the Oscars, but it's not too late to recap our thoughts on the awards ceremony. Plus, Tyler Perry's worst opening weekend debut? Is this the end of an era? It's the Kevin and Tim Show, all ahead on Picture Lock. You're watching or listening to Picture Lock, where we focus on film. Now, this audience first met my guest on the State of Black Cinema panel episode, where he thoroughly entertained with his friendly back and forth with DC Film Office director Pierre Bagley. Now he's here to talk about film and why he loves it so much. Tim Gordon, founder of the Black Reel Awards and WAFCA president, the titles go on and on, but anyway, welcome to the show, sir. I'm glad to have you.
I can't follow that, man. Thank you, man. It's good to be back.
Yeah, man. So we definitely loved having you on in the panel episode. That was pretty funny. You had, as you said, you had your Malcolm on versus Pierre's Martin.
It is what it is, man. And as you remember me telling them famously, you know, I didn't make this stuff up tonight, man. I mean, you were right. You were a black guy before we got here. But yeah, that was fun last time we were here.
Yeah, it was exciting. So I always love to start at the beginning. Mm-hmm. When did you first fall in love with film?
Man, I fell in love with film, really understanding it, probably in the late 70s, man. And what I meant by that is my father at the time worked for the Newark Star-Ledger in New Jersey, which would be the equivalent in Newark, New Jersey, of like the Washington Post here in D.C.
Okay.
And I remember one night he came home with a book from MGM that was their production schedule for like the next 5 years. And I remember at that moment being struck because I'd never seen anything like that before. Mm. You know, the ability to project films 5 years. Now we know it's commonplace that you pick up the trades and you'll see that information, but as kind of like a 13-year-old kid, I was like, wow, this is nice.
Right.
So I always loved movies because my father loved movies and he transferred that down to me. But what I picked up at that point is I wanted to be involved in the business in some facet, but I knew I didn't want to be an actor, not necessarily a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. I knew I had the ability to write. So criticism, which would come some years later. But I just was an avid movie watcher, and I went through a period, at least for about 3 years, where I watched almost every movie that was released week in, week out. So every movie. So there was I was stationed in the Marine Corps at that time, and there was a theater that on Thursdays had Dollar Thursday.
Okay.
And I would watch literally four movies every Thursday, man. You know, and I'm not advising you to do this at home, where you pay for one. And it comes with three free ones.
Right.
But I watched so many movies, and people would come to me because they knew what my passion was. And, I was always giving out my reviews even before I was a critic. Mm. So years later, it was just something that almost felt natural. And I thought that it was a place that I ended up. And it has been very nice for the last 22 years, wow. You know, just watching movies, man.
Wow. Wow. That's watching crazy. Yeah. So, I mean, you kind of hit the points that I wanted to get into, which is how you got into film criticism. But Film Gordon, who is he and how did you come up with the name?
Man, Film Gordon, believe it or not, I was working at, I produced radio for 12 years. I left radio and got a job, believe it or not, at BET. And I was the entertainment producer, which is a fancy way of saying they have a nice, huge website that has about 5 million folks that hit it daily. Mm. And that the largest segment of that site was the music aspect, which makes sense, music videos on BET.
Right.
But the second largest aspect, which is the area that I ran, was the entertainment channel. Mm. And while at BET, I was only there for a year, but while at BET, I introduced some innovations that I'm not sure if they're still doing today. Like we did the first live Oscar kind of, not necessarily like before Twitter came out and people do it, everybody does it now.
Right.
But I had the staff in for the Oscars that year, and I'd only been on the job about a month. We were doing live stuff with the Oscars, so that was really cool. The aspect of social media was really kind of relatively new. I mean, there was Facebook. Mm. I think there was Twitter, but I'm saying it wasn't as large as it was now. And a lot of the social media platforms that we use today, like we talked about Foursquare and some of the other stuff, Pinterest,
right,
didn't really exist back in 07.
Okay.
So they started having us, you know, introduce these blogs. And I kind of created the first blog, movie blog over at BET called What the Flick. Never mind. So let it go. So I learned my blogging and a lot of the aspects of what I use today with Film Gordon from BET. Mm. And when I left BET, I know I needed to develop a brand. So the Film Gordon brand was born back in early 2008. And it's grown not only to the site, but now the radio show that I host every week, Keeping It Real with Film Gordon.
Right.
Film Gordon, you know, I have a YouTube channel, Film Gordon TV. So Film Gordon has served me well. It speaks specifically to who I am.
Right.
I love film. Film is my passion. My last name is Gordon. It's an offshoot of Flash Gordon, Film Gordon.
Okay, that's what I was kind of wondering if there was any ties there.
Mm-hmm.
But okay, cool.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people think that being a film critic is an easy job, right? You just go watch movies, and you and I both know that it is not an easy job. It can be time consuming. Sometimes you might be giving up, you know, money just to make sure that you get your review done on time and all that kind of stuff. But for me as a film critic, I know I stay busy, but as the president of the Washington DC Area Film Critics Association, I know you must be even busier.
Whoa.
So just if you could let us know, you know, what does it all entail? What do you have to do as a president of a film critic organization?
You see me shaking my head. I'm like, and you left out that I also I founded and run actively at the same time the Black Reel Awards.
Oh, we were gonna get to it, bro.
But I think what's interesting about all three of these things that I do that are all film related, I've figured out ways to to kind of repurpose a lot of that content or repurpose a lot of my interests so that it serves everything that I'm doing. For an example, this whole film festival aspect of what I've gotten into, I just attended the Sundance Film Fest a couple of months ago. Several months ago, I was down at the Virginia Film Fest in Charlottesville. I was at the Middleburg Film Fest. Of course, I do Urban World, so I mix in Black Film Fest, you know, major white film fest. A lot of that has to do with, in my role as WAFCA president, that's more of a policy role, which basically means that we run an association with members like you that are in,
mm-hmm.
and if there are issues with the studios, myself and other members of our executive team are tasked with making sure that the services, everything works well for you or the membership of our group.
Right.
I'm called on to make decisions like what days do we do our award shows? How do we get the word out? You know, just a lot of the administrative things. I'm kind of like the guy who's the representative or ally, which represents the studio. So that's that role.
Mm.
As it relates to the Black Reel Awards, that role is strictly one of someone who has to see as many films as possible that may be films that our members are going to vote on. So instead of relying solely on, hey, I know this film or this guy's in the film, I like to see as many of them as possible because we, throughout the year, we create, you know, what we call a short list, which is really dumb because the list is long as hell. It's not short.
Uh-huh.
But it's a short list that we put together for our voters. And I think we have about 33 voters who, you know, range, half of them African-American, the other half are non-African-American. You have people who work, who are bloggers, as well as folks who work at major publications like the Chicago Sun-Times, Washington Post, New York Daily News. So, I mean, we have a cross-section of voters that vote on that award show.
Okay.
And then there's the role of me as the talk show host, the guy who does a show once a week, which I'm really proud of that show. We've had about 1 million downloads in 4.5 years.
Wow.
Had over 125 guests, like A-listers, like, you know, Denzel Washington, Tyler Perry, Angelina Jolie. I mean, everybody, there's been a lot of people on that show. Oprah Winfrey's done the show.
Yeah.
So I'm really proud of the work on Keeping It Real with Film Gordon, because it also gives me an excuse to weekly talk to major film critics who just happen to be my friends, and not just people here in Washington, D.C., but folks across the country. So,
those are those roles,
and in watching all of these movies, that is the purpose of what it's all about.
Wow. Man, that's incredible. So, you know, a quick short story, and I think I told you this before, but for the audience anyways. When I was first coming up with Picture Lock, and I was thinking about what do I want to name this thing, I was like, okay, I'm going to name it Keeping It Real. So I Googled, and I was like, oh, okay, there can't be any other Keeping It Reals out there. Of course, Keeping It Real with Film Gordon. So that's when I first, this might have been a year and a half, I don't know how long ago. And that's when I got into the show. And like you said, you just have a fabulous show. I definitely enjoy it. You keep it real. It's real relaxed, conversational, but it's always fun and exciting.
I keep it too real sometimes, man.
Sometimes.
I do, man, because, you know, there are people who won't do my show because we've kept it too real. Or as Dave Chappelle once said, when keeping it real goes wrong.
Right. So, okay, one of the things that I did want to ask you in regards to black cinema, and we obviously talked about this, and one of the comments that you made with Pierre is that, you know, as a critic, a lot of times the studios will ask you who's your audience and things like that. And so that going into the Black Reel Awards, obviously black cinema, black artists, is something that you really care about. So what pricked your heart to actually start the Black Reel Awards?
Well, that basically came about because as a young person for years, of course, if you love movies, of course, you've got to love the major award shows, you know. And you also have to remember that the Oscars are the granddaddy. The Globes have been around for a long period of time. A lot of these other shows, like the SAG Awards or the DGA and the PGA, those are kind of like lesser shows to a certain extent. But I always loved the Oscars. And I remember in the 1990s, when I first started working in this business, there were people who were really getting passed over. I remember Denzel Washington famously not winning an Oscar in 93 for Malcolm X in 92.
Right.
I remember both Lawrence Fishburne and Angela Bassett being nominated for What's Love Got to Do with It a couple of years later and being passed over. And then there were other performances that I thought were awards worthy, and we'll talk about what the phrase award worthy means. But it really came to a head, though, Kevin, in 1996 when they had the infamous Hollywood blackout, when the only person who was nominated of color that year was a woman named Diane Houston for a short film called, I think it was, I want to say Tuesday Morning Ride. I might be incorrect on what day of the week it is, but it was something Morning Ride.
Right.
And, you know, African Americans were boycotting. And I had already been playing around earlier in the decade, like when I used to do a newsletter back in 1992 called the Renaissance Review. And we played with the idea of doing something called the Oscar Michaud Awards, where we had like six categories, you know, actor, actress, supporting actor, actress, director, film. So that was kind of like the first kind of shot of what this whole Black Reel Award thing would later be. So I remember back in 99, I was sitting around and I said, you know, I got this idea and I think I want to move forward on it. And we came up with the name, we came up with the logo, myself and my original partner, Sabrina McNeil.
Okay.
And we launched it. And I think, you know, when you talk about kismet or, you know, luck or timing, we launched it right as the internet was taken off, which basically meant that we were able to do a program locally, put it up online, and then it started to circulate around, you know, initially in smaller ripples initially, but over time, it really grew into something large. So I had another gentleman come on and assist us in kind of documenting the history of the show. And this guy's name is Cordell Martin, who's a friend of mine who lives in Indiana but works with us. And Cordell is the one, like if you go online right now and you Google Black Reel Awards, you go to Wikipedia, it's there. You go to IMDb, to the Internet Movie Database. Everybody who's ever been nominated for a Black Reel Award, it listed as a major award. So I'm really thankful that, you know, although I'm out in front as the creator and the and kind of driving force, I'm not the one that that kind of does all the what I call the grunt work. So I'm you know, that so that's kind of the Black Reel Award journey. I'm not sure if that it answered your question.
It did, it did. yeah, it did. No, I mean, you know, I'm trying to process it all. But you know, in the course of your conversation, you were dropping some jewels. You said the Oscar Micheaux Award. So can you tell the
audience who Oscar Micheaux is?
Exactly.
Oscar Micheaux, when I first got into this business, I got into it as a guy who studied the history of black film before I even became like the film critic guy.
Okay.
So Oscar Micheaux, along with filmmakers like Spencer Williams, Ralph Cooper, there were several other guys, were like the African Americans who were like the foundation of like what we know today as kind of like black cinema. Oscar Micheaux was an entrepreneur and an author who in 1917 or 1916 wrote a book called The Homesteader. And around that time, there were two other guys who had a studio. I think it was Lincoln and Johnson Noble. Now, you got to remember, the first African-American to make a movie, his name was William Foster. And this is around 1909, 1910. So at this point, cinema is really new.
Right.
D.W. Griffin had kind of broken through in a major way in 1914 with Birth of a Nation that really kind of showed people the power of what cinema could be.
Right.
And at that point, everybody wanted to jump in. There was no Hollywood at that time because that doesn't happen until like the early 1920s. But Oscar Micheaux is the guy that a lot of people need to really understand is kind of like the father of this thing.
Right.
Because what Micheaux was able to do in a way that like Spike Lee would later do, like Tyler Perry does now.
Right.
He was able to create his own content, write his own movies, cast them, direct them, produce them, you know, and literally at that point, there was no distribution system. There was no 20th Century Fox, Warner Brothers, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
Micheaux would put his movies on his back, take them from town to town to town, and show his movies. But the thing that's I love about talking about Oscar Micheaux is that he, over the course of a 30-year career, made 40 movies. Now think about that.
Right.
Now the only other person who has that level of output today would be Well, Spike Lee has done it over like 25 years. I think he's got about 40 movies.
One point something per year.
You know? So Spike, Tyler Perry. There's not a lot of people who can churn out content in that way.
Right.
And Oscar Micheaux was an early one. Like I said, Spencer Williams had his run like in the late 30s, mid to late 30s, 40s. Ralph Cooper, who would later become the MC at the Apollo, made films on that time. So it was really a special period. And I always speculate, and I'm going to wrap this up really quickly. I always speculate that when the studio system was created in the 1920s, there was a lot of these guys who were in New York that left and then came west and created these studios. Where would we have been today if, say, Oscar Micheaux and other folks who thought like Micheaux were able to have a studio of their own in the 1920s that could have grown into something larger today?
Yeah.
I surmise that that would have largely changed the course of film history. And I've been thinking about it for a while. I'm like, I should write a book about that.
That is something incredible to think about because, you know, I hate to say it always seems like black artists hustle, right? So in hip hop, when they couldn't get it from the studios, they were selling the records from the back of their trunk, you know, doing their own self-distribution. And just like you said with Oscar Michaud, I mean, that's amazing to me that this is not a time in which they even had, you know, fast cars or, you know, this infrastructure to get around, but he was able to some kind of way distribute his film. I mean, that's just incredible to me.
Man, that brother's deep, man. We owe him a him. There are certain what I call seminal figures in film. Michaud is one. Sidney Poitier is another one, which is another entirely different story about there were no such thing as a black leading man before Poitier in 50.
Right.
And when you're talking about Michaud, we're talking about that doesn't happen until like 30 years later. Mm. So it has always been an uphill battle, but I think it has a lot to do with looking at film as society, looking that you know, there was racism during that time. Michaud, even within the constructs of that, was still able to effectively operate and leave work behind that you can still watch to this day.
Right. Man, we could do it.
I'm sorry,
rap, man.
You were going someplace else.
That's how we were going. So before we wrap out this segment, mm-hmm. I did want to ask you, you know, Jay-Z said he said there's some kid somewhere that is eating a box of a bowl of Apple Jacks and writing the next hot rhymes, like, going to take my place, you know? So in the same way, like, what would you give, what advice would you give for the film critics of the next generation who are coming up, who are studying film, as to how to be a better film critic?
Well, I would like to see, it's interesting you would bring up Jay-Z. I would like to see somebody come into the film game and take that, as you said, hustler sensibility, but also understand that the model of what a film critic was when I first got in has evolved to the point. And I'm not really sure exactly where it's going, because at this point, anybody can be a critic.
Right.
But I think in order to really understand the game of film criticism, one needs to really watch movies. Mm. You can't be a critic if, like, all your knowledge is like everything you saw in the 90s to now, and like without ever having understood what what a studio system was, who the greats were, you know, what right. important figures in the game were. So I think for somebody, for younger people, I would always tell them, you watch a lot of movies, but then also apply a sensibility of looking at all the mediums, thinking about it not only as a writer, but thinking about it as a radio personality, a television personality. You've got to be multifaceted mm-hmm. to win as a film critic. You know, the days of people like Roger Ebert,
right.
who would win a Pulitzer Prize writing a review,
yeah.
and then, you know, finding himself on a television show. You know, even before he died, Roger Ebert was blowing up on social media. He got it and understood that it was an evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think it's going to take for young people who are interested, who just love movies, but see this as a career.
Yeah, wow. Man, I'm loving this conversation. Let's take a quick break. And we'll be right back with more with Film Gordon himself.
This is Jason Fraley, film critic with WTOP Radio, and you're watching Picture Lock.
With the 86th Academy Awards show behind us, selfies, delivered pizza, and all, I know, Tim, you have some thoughts on the show, and I want to get to that. The host and the top winners of the night. What did you think of Ellen's return to hosting?
I thought it was entertaining, man. I mean, but let me preface this by saying, much like a film critic who goes in with really low expectations, and like you give them anything positive, and they're like, oh, that was good. Well, you got to remember, Seth MacFarlane hosted the 85th annual Academy
right.
Awards, which were absolutely terrible. So there was only one way to go, and it was up. And I thought Ellen was really entertaining. I thought she did a great job. I was hosting an Oscar party down at the Arlington Cinema and Draft House.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really interesting sitting in a room full of people watching some of her bits and some of the jokes that, like, really didn't, you know, that the audience didn't really get or they groaned.
Right.
Famously, the one about Liza Minnelli, because personally, they didn't, when we're watching the show, I wasn't really sure that was Liza Minnelli But until the next day, and I was like, oh, damn.
Right.
But the joke was funny.
Oh, man.
So that.
Did you see the picture on social media? Oh, man, it was so sad. Of the, you know, the infamous selfie at this point.
Right.
And they showed, what was it? It was something about, like, showing everyone's face. But then they showed Liza Minnelli didn't make it. No, she didn't make it. Like, they showed from behind, and she's, like, standing trying to get into the shot. Dude, it was so bad. It was so bad.
But, yes, for the most part, I thought the show went well. I loved how the Oscar folks, the older Academy, kind of really tried to do outreach for younger audiences, you know, the whole Pharrell set piece.
Right.
I thought that worked well. I just thought that there was just way too much Botox and plastic surgery. Kim Novak scared me. She looked like Heath Ledger as in The Dark Knight. And I put that on Facebook and people laughed. But I'm saying, I mean, did you see her face?
Oh, man.
John Travolta?
I saw it. That was...
Goldie Hawn? I'm just saying. I'm just the messenger. Don't kill me at home. But I'm just saying that there were some moments at the Oscars that were truly bizarre.
Yeah.
But the big six, you always hear me talk about the big six like we just did in the last segment.
Yeah.
It was really predictable because all during award season with Film Critics Associations as well as the Globes and leading into Oscar, it was, you know, McConaughey, Leto, Lupita Nyong'o, Cate Blanchett, Alfonso Cuarón, in 12 Years a Slave, and that's exactly how it played out on Oscar night.
Right.
So it was kind of predictable.
Yeah.
Not a lot of surprises. I think the biggest surprise was her winning for Best Original Screenplay, because that could have gone either way. I'm just saying from a surprise that we knew going in, because I remember putting up on Facebook, like, before the Oscars started, I said, look for these six winners right here.
Right.
But, you know, so everybody sort of understood that going in. But the her, it was a pleasant surprise. I liked her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It worked for me.
I do want to get into go through the top six just to see, like, if there were any that you disagreed with or anything. But my man Philippe in there doing the technical directing. Yeah, what up, Philippe? So I was hosting as well an Oscar party here.
Right.
And in the pool, it was a three-way tie for first place. And we both only missed three. So, like you said, I think it was pretty predictable if you're very intuitive know what's going on. So let's go into it. Best actor, Matthew McConaughey. Did you think he should have won, or, you know, should have gone to Mr. Ejiofor?
Well, before we even start, you got to really understand one important fact about the Oscars, that the Oscars are not about merit.
Right.
And what that means is that generally people are under the perception that, you know, the best performance is the one that's going to win every year. And that's not really the case. Matthew McConaughey, love him to death, and yes, he did deserve to win, but he won a combo Oscar. I mean, anybody who's watched Matthew McConaughey over the years knows that he has effectively transitioned from a guy who used to make, like, really stupid rom-coms like Fool's Gold and, you know, Failure to Launch. And over the last 18 months with, you know, three strong performances last year in films like The Paperboy, Killer Joe, and, Killer Joe. Oh, Magic Mike. This year he comes out, and of course there's Mud, which if you would flip Mud and Dallas Buyers Club and put Mud at the end of the year, he would still got an Oscar nomination because he was great in that as well.
Yeah.
His little small moment that he had in The Wolf of Wall Street, that was great. And then also it didn't hurt that at the same time all these performances are being viewed by voters, that they turn on HBO and True Detective is on with him and Woody Harrelson.
Right.
So when I called it a combo award, it's not a disrespect to his performance in the Dallas Buyers Club, but he had a body of work over the last 18 months, and they was like, you know what, we need to recognize him, and that was his Oscar win.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. I definitely think that what he went through just to get into the role, you know, itself, It was definitely Oscar worthy. You know,
yeah, Hollywood loves when you lose weight.
Yeah,
you play somebody with a disability. You know, my left foot.
Right.
You know, that's a Hollywood.
Forrest Gump. Yeah, we can go.
Daniel Day Lewis lose an eye. Right. Gangs of New York. I mean, they love that kind of thing.
Right. Right. All right. So, best actress, Kate Blanchett. I finally. When I did the Oscar predictions Picture Lock episode, I hadn't seen it, but I knew Kate was going to win because, of course, you know, just doing all my reviewing and studying. But I finally saw the film, I think, a couple days ago, and I actually thought she really did a great job. But I do think it probably should have gone to Sandra. But the only thing about it's Sandra sometimes, you know what I mean? But, like, for her to put on the performance that she did, virtually with nothing but a green screen around her. I mean, she probably, dare I say, should have gotten it. I do think Kate had a tough performance. It was very emotional, and you could just see the nuance. And so you forget Kate and, you know, whatever, Jasmine.
Blue Jasmine.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. All you see is that character on the screen. And then, of course, you know, the screenwriting, the script, it was excellent. You know, just how it's slowly revealing, you know, what happened in the past, but catching you up with what's going on presently. So what did you think about it?
I thought Kate Blanchett easily won that award because, as you just described, it's the nuance when you watch Blue Jasmine of watching this woman really become unhinged right in front of your very eyes. And I think Blanchett knocked it out of the park. Now, the problem with Sandra Bullock, because as much as I love Gravity, mm-hmm. at its core, Gravity is a technical marvel.
Right.
That is a story of people trying to survive, trying to get back to Earth to survive. But honestly, I don't think that the success of Gravity, not to say that anybody could have played that role, because I thought Sandra Bullock was pretty solid in it, mm-hmm. but when you put that performance next to what Kate Blanchett did, Blanchett is just brilliant in this film, which is why she won her second Oscar very easily. Because mm-hmm. that film was released probably in June, July, like one of the summer months. And while we're going to talk about Fruitvale Station a little later on when I talk about movies that I think deserve more recognition, mm-hmm. that was a movie and a performance that people, they saw it, they loved it in June or July, whenever it was released. And, like, no matter what else came, you know, Kate Blanchett's name never fell off anybody's lips
right.
through the Critics Association period, the Globes period, and finally through the Oscars.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. All right, so Best Supporting Actor, Jared Leto, thoughts?
Easy. when I saw, I remember seeing Dallas Buyers Club and telling somebody, I said, you know, I don't think it's the best film of the year, but when you got two performances like McConaughey and Leto, and I knew Leto was a lock. Nobody mm-hmm. was going to beat Jared Leto last year for that mm-hmm. Oscar. Much in the way, if you think about when you saw Ray and you saw Jamie Foxx, well, nobody's going to beat
right.
him that year. So, I mean, who would have beat him? What performance was better than that last year?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, I definitely thought Michael Fassbender killed it. But obviously, like you said, I mean, it was like... with Daniel Day-Lewis as Lincoln. Like, there were some stellar performances that year, but it's Daniel Day-Lewis. Like,
now!
Yeah!
Now! I'm sorry.
Nah, that's all right. All right, Lupita Nyong'o, best supporting. I have no qualms about that.
Well,
I think that was excellent.
Well, I knew she had a good shot. What I was afraid of is that Jennifer Lawrence had won last year for Silver Linings Playbook and was getting so much buzz for American Hustle. Mm. And the only reason why I stuck with my guns and thought that Lupita Nyong'o probably had a much better shot this year is because Lawrence is 23 years old. She's already been nominated for 3 Oscars. Mm. And you got to be really special and really well-liked in Hollywood to win back-to-back. You know, I think Hanks had won back-to-back. I'm trying to think. It may have been one other person, but back-to-back doesn't happen often.
Okay.
And I was like, if Jennifer Lawrence wins back-to-back, they really like her. And apparently she didn't. So it's not that they don't really like her.
Right.
but she's young and she's going to have more shots. She is immensely talented.
Yeah.
But Lupita Nyong'o, when you say the phrase killed it, oh my God. she's the heart and soul of 12 Years a Slave, mm-hmm. which is the film that won Best Picture. So right. it makes perfect sense that she would win that award.
Yeah, definitely. Mm-hmm. All right, so I guess we can flip it, Best Picture, and then we'll get into Best Director. 12 Years a Slave, what did you think? Deserved?
12 Years a Slave is the one movie that I've seen recently that it's not even a movie. Like, I always tell people, like, my closing line is, you know, see something good at the movies next week. Mm-hmm. 12 Years a Slave is not a movie you go in looking for enjoyment. It's right. just a movie to experience.
Right.
And when you see a film that is so superior to its entire genre. So you think before 12 Years a Slave came out, the quintessential film about slavery was Roots.
Yeah.
And this movie, I mean, no disrespect to Roots, but it's 2013. You know, it's a film versus a television show. And the ability to tell a story and it be unflinching, in your face, you know, it's like everybody in the audience, it was like the closest you can get to slavery without being a slave for about 2 hours plus. It's just it was just a brilliant film. It made me yeah. terribly uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I remember walking out of it, I feeling like somebody had hit me inside the head with a 2x4 because I was just like, my eyes were glazed over. I was like, right. you better not ask me. Nobody say nothing funny about
right, right. That was like, oh, man. That was like watching Rosewood. After right. that, you got to be like, hey, I need to be by myself for right. like for a little while. Like, I don't need to go out in public. I might strike out, hit somebody or something.
Because it was a powerful, it's tough. Powerful experience.
So tough. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Definitely. All right, so Alfonso Cuarón is Best Director. I mean, personally, I felt like you said, for the technical marvel that he created, for the world that he created, even though, again, this is up against green screen for, you know, inventing these different things, I do feel like Gravity moved film forward technically with that film. But then at the same time, it's like I wish you could split, like, break it in two and give the other half to Steve McQueen, because like you said, I mean, that 12 Years a Slave was just such a powerful film. I mean, it's a film that I don't plan to watch again anytime soon. You know what I mean?
Like, right.
I was good after I saw that.
Right.
That. So
I always said, you know, like, what would be cool? Like, hey, baby, it's a Friday night. I got a pizza. We gonna watch Precious and 12 Years a Slave. Yeah, that's a good
right. Fast the tissues.
No, but you're right about Gravity. I remember the first time I went to a screening and I was looking at this movie and like the opening scene where you just see like a side of Earth and there's this little speck, and then like as time evolves, it comes closer into your view and you see Clooney and Bullock. I just think that it, like you said, moving film forward is absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. It is just a technical marvel. And I think if you look at how the awards were given out this year, there's a little something for everybody. You know, Steve McQueen doesn't win Best Director, but he still, as a producer on 12 Years a Slave, gets a chance to stand on the stage right. and be acknowledged for his work.
Right.
Alfonso Cuarón, the first Mexican director to ever win an Academy Award. So the Academy is always into let's make history, and it was good for him. So I liked how everything was spread out. I mean, it would have been easy with Gravity winning 7 awards to give Gravity Best Picture, but I think you don't knock 12 Years a Slave out. A film like that has to be acknowledged by the Academy.
Right.
And I think they did a really good job with it.
Yeah, definitely. All right, well, moving on, let's, Tyler Perry, he just released Single Moms Club at the tune of $8.3 million this right. weekend. His right. worst box office debut and his last with Lionsgate. Mm-hmm. So what did you think about that? And is this a symbolizing, you know, the end of Tyler's reign or what?
Well, I would say, as a person who has not been the strongest proponent of Tyler's work since he began his reign in 2005, I would not say it is the end of Tyler, but it is clear to me that changes are going to have to be made, because the last two movies that Tyler Perry has made, to me, show a regression in his talent. And what I mean by that, I'm sure there's somebody at home going, his talent, what talent would that be? Tyler Perry, I think, has a loyal audience of people who really enjoy his work. I, in the minority, don't happen to be one of them because I find his work to be very surfacey. Whereas somebody like a Spike Lee, who came along and had work that, and it's different. I mean, I understand you can't compare one director's work to another director's work, but where Lee made films that I think were more substantive, where he kind of made films that were of, you know, of the period, of the late 80s, mid to late 80s, early 90s, you know, you're dealing with subjects in films like Do the Right Thing. You're looking at, you know, class issues in the African American community in films like School Days, able to create a very successful take and memorable take of a slain civil rights leader in Malcolm X. So Spike Lee, his legend is secure,
right,
as probably one of the best in the game, not only for that period but among his peer group.
Right.
Perry, on the other hand, as I said, makes films that kind of, you know, that super serve his target audience.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, people like you and I, critics, were like, you know, yeah, you know, these films are terrible.
Right.
And the audience didn't care. But what I noticed back in December when I saw Madea Christmas, and then specifically last week when I saw The Single Moms Club, is that in his effort to broaden his work, which means that he's putting more non-African Americans on the screen. You know, you had Bob, Larry the Cable Guy, I think his name was, along with, you know, Eugene Levy and some other folks in the Madea Christmas. And I remember sitting there because at Perry movies, I always listen to his audience because it tells me whether or not the audience that he's making these films for, are they actually enjoying them? Are they getting the jokes, et cetera?
Right.
And I remember the audience being a little disappointed back for the Christmas film because the humor for the first time with Madea in it wasn't driven by Madea, but driven by Larry the Cable Guy and these redneck jokes.
Right.
So for me, I was like, wow, that's not bad because there was not that much Madea in it. But for his audience, they were like, there's not that much Madea in it.
Right.
And then this film, This last week, I'm telling you, man, it was the when I saw it at 10:40 at night because Perry doesn't screen his films
right.
for critics.
Yeah.
And I wanted to see it before Friday so I could talk about it. And I got there late. I mean, not late. The movie screened late. And I'd seen two previous movies that day, so I was sort of kind of tired. So I'm nodding in and out because the movie's not really giving me a lot. And I'm not making this up. When I sat down, there were probably about 20 or 30 people there in the theater.
Yeah.
And every time I nodded and I got back and I looked back up, there were less people in the theater. So at one point, I nodded and I got up and I looked to my right and I looked to my left. I said, and it was two people behind me. I was like, where is everybody at? So
wow.
people bailed out and I heard the woman really? Behind me at the end go, this is the worst movie. This is terrible. It was like watching a bad Lifetime movie the jokes didn't work.
Right.
The transitions were bad. I saw Perry did something with his makeup that I was just like, dude, I don't understand it. There was a scene in the film with a mother trying to talk to her daughter. Just terrible acting. I said it felt like he has a two-take maximum on his films.
Mm.
Like, all right, we're going to practice this one time. We're going to run through it. And then the second time we do it, print that. So Perry needs to go back to the drawing board because this type of lazy filmmaking
right.
has finally caught up with you when your movie doesn't even break $10 million.
Yeah.
And I mean, think about it. The worst movie that Tyler had that had his name on it was People's that was released last summer. But Perry didn't direct that movie. He just put his name on it and produced it. But Perry's films, as a rule, and I tell people all the time, his Madea films average $60 million at the box office per film. His non-Madea films average, before this one, average $50. When you talk about a Perry movie that can't even clear $10 million in the opening weekend,
right.
as Beyonce would say, sound the alarm. Something's wrong.
Right, right.
Something's wrong.
Man, see, now, Tyler Perry is the filmmaker that I love to hate, right? So right. I love him as an entrepreneur, you know, for all the Oscar Michelle qualities about him, right? But then as a filmmaker, I hate him, you know, and especially for me who actually went to school, studied film, all that kind of stuff. And it's like, granted, he hustled, he was able to get into film. And honestly, you know, he started out with the plays. And I remember back when I was in undergrad, you know, when people down the hall would be like, hey, I got this new Madea play, you know, it's like, oh, what's that? And it was like all the rave.
Right.
And then, you know, to transfer that onto the screen and all that good stuff. But I think he had a formula, and the formula is now broken. To me, he's like, I'm making all these hip hop references, but he's like 50 Cent, right? So on his first album, when he came out, he started that beef with Ja Rule, right? And it was so huge, like, oh man, you know, 50's a real gangster. He got shot. Ja Rule sings, you know what I mean? And so like everybody went and bought the album. I mean, but it was solid, it was good. But then on the next album, he starts a beef with Fat Joe. And you're like, okay, but whatever, I'll buy the album. And by the third one, he tried to start another beef.
With
but
Kanye.
It was just like, yeah. And he said after that he was going to quit rap, but Kanye, you know, blew him out the water. Anyways, so it's like the formula is broken. In the same way, I think with Perry, you know, we know we're going to have, you know, a broken down, you know, broken soul of a woman who is with the wrong guy. The right guy comes along, repairs her soul, you know, brings her to church. And not that I have any problem with the church aspect of it, but it's that formula that I feel is not working, and it hasn't been for a while, but it's kind of like McDonald's French fries, right? You go and you get those fries, and you're remembering that time that you were a kid and they were salty, it was hot, it was good, it was. In the same way with Tyler Perry, I think they're looking for that Madea where it was funny, she was snapping, you know, all this kind of stuff, and it's just not there. And not only that, like you said, with him trying to broaden his audience and things like that. Mm-hmm. I just don't think he's successful at that. He just has to, honestly, I think what I would love to see is for him to go away for a while in regards to filmmaking. He already has, I think it was on Twitter, he had like a picture of him and like the Tyler Perry Show is gonna be on OWN now. He has the Haves and Have Nots. And for better or for worse, and all these other shows, and it's like he's doing too much. And Pierre has said something that I thought was poignant in terms of, you know, Donald Trump doesn't paint the apartments.
Right, he doesn't lease the apartment, paint the apartment.
Exactly.
Rent the apartment.
And that's the problem with Tyler. He's just doing way too much. So,
I was sitting there listening to you, and I'm thinking through the years, like, how I've attacked this guy. And I went so hard at Tyler Perry that I had to pull back, and I had to go, it's really not personal, because I've only met him once. Don't profess to have any relationship with him. I've never interviewed him like some people that I know.
Mm-hmm.
My issue, and I really want people to really understand this, because this is probably the first time I'm going to articulate it in this way. Part of what bothers me so much about his style of filmmaking is that I'm a guy that truly loves film. And if you're going to be in the game,
right,
you know, be in the game in a way, and this is what I think Spike Lee was trying to say, not just to Tyler Perry, but 20 years earlier for Matty Rich, that you can't get in the game of film as hard as it is to make a movie, as hard as it is to raise money to make a movie, as hard as it is to get a movie distributed, and then get in the game, not take it seriously enough, or get in the game and be real lackadaisical about it. Like Matty Rich, you know, I never went to film school. You know, who needs film school? Right. I made straight out of Brooklyn. Well, Tyler Perry didn't necessarily come with the attitude of who needs film school, but he took his hustle, his stage play hustle, and brought it to the big screen. I just wish that before he made the transition to becoming a full-time director, that he probably hired somebody for not just his first film, but maybe two or three films,
right,
to really understand what it's all about and to kind of like not be like a one-stop, do everything sort of a guy. I don't understand now why he still employs that model.
Right.
Because you would think that may have been your hustle model early in the game. But at this point, you know, you should just be able to hire some folks, do what you need to do, and get and produce quality work.
Yeah. No, I mean I totally agree with you. And like you said, it's nothing personal. It's as a lover of film, as someone who loved it enough to be in debt to student loans for film, you know what I mean?
Right, it makes
you mad when you're like, dude, if I could have the money that you have to make some quality movies, you know what I mean? And it's more about the quality. And like you said, I think Spike was one of the reasons that I wanted to get into filmmaking, directing. And like you said earlier, he has sealed, his mark in history because of all the great films that he has made. And so I think I side with Spike as well. It's just about the quality. And everybody can, you know, like some people can get into the NBA off of natural talent, but the people that actually studied the fundamentals of basketball are the ones that are gonna stay super successful. You know what I mean? The ones that are in the gym all the time working on the fundamentals. And I think when you miss the fundamentals a lot of time, that's when that formula, you know, can get stale and contrite. But man, it's been, honestly, it's been great talking with you, Tim. We got to have you back on the show. If you could let the viewers know where they can find you and all the 50 million websites you're on.
I was going to tell you the easiest way now is I created an About Me page because that is all my links to all my work. So the easiest way to find me would just be about.me/FilmGordon.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, did I say that right? About.me.com. Maybe there's a .com in there somewhere, but About Me, Film Gordon. That's the easiest way to find me these days.
Okay, cool. Well, Tim, thank you so much for coming on.
Man, not a problem, man. I'm sorry, man. You know, that time flies by when it's me and you.
yeah, definitely. All right, don't go anywhere. We'll be right back for the wrap up.
I'm Victor Nolasco.
And I'm Steven Rubin.
And we're the directors of The Jackie Movie. And you are watching Picture Lock.
I'd like to thank Tim Gordon for coming on the show. Be sure to check out his film reviews, interviews, and giveaways on thefilmgordon.com. I have to thank my crew for braving the weather and coming out to make this happen. If it wasn't for Charles Smith, Paul Mahood, Craig Syfax, LJ Lacoma, and Philippe Diaz and Kim Riley, this show wouldn't have been possible. So thank you guys. I really do appreciate it. You can find Picture Lock on Facebook and Twitter. Don't forget to check out the website for movie reviews, news, free screenings in the DMV area, and if you're interested in being a guest on the show. Maybe you don't want to be in the hot seat as a guest, but you do enjoy watching the show. Well, subscribe to our newsletter online so that you can be alerted for your chance to be in our live studio audience. In fact, we have a Women in Cinema panel Monday, March 24th, and we'd love to see you here. Check out the news section on picturelockshow.com for more details. And until next time, I hope you stay locked on film.